He simply acquiesced. As far as I was concerned, he wrote, his decision was one of non-interference, basically a decision not to upset the existing plans. Truman did not so much say yes as not say no. Groves described Truman scornfully as a little boy on a toboggan. Truman left Potsdam on August 2nd. The following day, Burns' assistant wrote in his diary, aboard Augusta, President Leahy, JFB agreed. Japs looking for peace. Truman also wanted peace, but first he wanted to use the atomic bomb. General Douglas MacArthur, the supreme commander of Allied forces in the Pacific, and the second highest-ranking active duty officer in the U.S. Army, considered the bomb completely unnecessary from a military point of view, and became both angry and depressed when he learned that the United States was about to use it. He held a press conference on August 6th, before the bomb drop was announced, and told reporters that the Japanese were already beaten, and that he was thinking about the possibilities of a next war with its horrors magnified 10,000 times. On August 6th, at 2:45 a.m., three B-29s took off for Japan from the island of Tinian in the Marianas, 1,500 miles away. The lead plane, the Enola Gay, carried the uranium bomb, Little Boy, which exploded at 8:15 a.m., with a yield now estimated at 16 kilotons of TNT. Hiroshima's approximately 300,000 civilians, 43,000 soldiers, 45,000 Korean slave laborers, and several thousand Japanese Americans, mostly children whose parents were interned in the United States, were just beginning their day. The target was the T-shaped Aioi Bridge near the center of the city. Hiroshima, despite its port and Second General Army headquarters, had not been considered a priority military target for earlier bombing. The bomb totally destroyed an area, extending approximately 2 miles in all directions. Watching the city of Hiroshima disappear horrified the Enola Gay's crew members. The pilot, Paul Tibbets, who named the plane after his mother, described the scene below. The giant purple mushroom had already risen to a height of 45,000 feet, 3 miles above our own altitude, and was still boiling upward like something terribly alive. Even more fearsome was the sight on the ground below. Fires were springing up everywhere, amid a turbulent mass of smoke that had the appearance of bubbling hot tar. On another occasion, he reflected, if Dante had been with us on the plane, he would have been terrified. The city we had seen so clearly in the sunlight a few minutes before was now an ugly smudge. It had completely disappeared under this awful blanket of smoke and fire. Tail gunner Bob Caron called it a peep into hell. Co-pilot Robert Lewis wrote in his flight log, "My God, what have we done?" Radio man Abe Spitzer watched from the accompanying plane, the great artiste, and thought he was hallucinating. He provided the most graphic and terrifying description of what crew members witnessed, and one worth quoting at length. Below us, spread out almost as far as I could see, was a great fire, but it was like no ordinary fire. It contained a dozen colors, all of them blindingly bright, more colors than I imagined existed. And in the center, and brightest of all, a gigantic red ball of flame that seemed larger than the sun. Indeed, it seemed that, somehow, the sun had been knocked out of the sky and was on the ground below us and beginning to rise again, only coming straight up toward us, and fast. At the same time, the ball itself spread outward, too, until it seemed to cover the entire city. And on every side, the flame was shrouded, half hidden by a thick, impenetrable column of gray-white smoke, extending into the foothills beyond the city, and bursting outward and rising toward us with unbelievable speed. Then the ship rocked again, and it sounded as if a giant gun, Some large artillery or cannons were firing at us and hitting us from every direction. The purple light was changing to a green-blue now, with just a tinge of yellow at the edges. And from below the ball of fire, the upside-down sun seemed to be following the smoke upward, racing to us with immeasurably fast speed, although we at the same time, though not so quickly, were speeding away from what was left of the city. Suddenly we were to the left of the pillar of smoke, and it continued rising, to an estimated height, I later learned, of 50,000 feet. It looked like a kind of massive pole that narrowed toward the top and reached for the stratosphere. The scientists later told us they believed the pole was as much as 4 or 5 miles wide at its base and 1.5 miles or more wide at the top. As I watched, hypnotized by what I saw, the column of smoke changed its color from a gray-white to brown, then amber, then all three colors at once, mingled into a bright, boiling rainbow. For a second it looked as though its fury might be ending, but almost immediately a kind of mushroom spurted out of the top and traveled up, up to what some say was a distance of 60,000 or 70,000 feet. The whole column seethed and spurted, but the mushroom top shot out in every direction, like giant waves during an ocean storm. Then, quite suddenly, the top broke off the column, as if it had been cut away with a sharp blade, and it shot still further up. How far, I don't know. Nobody did or does. Not even the pictures show that, and none of the apparatus could measure it exactly. Some said it was 80,000 feet, some 85,000 feet, some even more. After that, another mushroom, somewhat smaller, boiled up out of the pillar. Spitzer heard someone say, "I wonder if maybe we're not monkeying around with things that are none of our business." The view from the ground was very different and far more harrowing. At the hypocenter, where temperatures reached 5,400 degrees Fahrenheit, the fireball roasted people to bundles of smoking black char in a fraction of a second as their internal organs boiled away. Tens of thousands were killed instantly. An estimated 140,000 were dead by the end of the year, and 200,000 by 1950. The United States officially reported that only 3,242 Japanese troops were killed. Among the casualties at Hiroshima were approximately 1,000 American citizens, mostly second-generation Japanese Americans, and 23 U.S. prisoners of war, some of whom survived the blast only to be beaten to death by bomb survivors. Several U.S. prisoners of war were killed by the bomb. Injured and burned survivors suffered immensely. Hibakusha, bomb-affected persons, described it as walking through hell. The streets were filled with an endless, ghost-like procession of horribly burned, often naked people, whose skin hung off their bones, desperately seeking help for their wounded bodies, searching for family members, and trying to escape from the encroaching fires. They tripped over dead bodies that had been seared into lumps of charcoal, often frozen in mid-step. Hiroshima's most renowned atomic bomb poet, Sankichi Toge, who died in 1953 at age 37, wrote a poem titled August 6th that reads in part, "How could I ever forget that flash of light? In an instant, 30,000 people disappeared from the streets. The cries of 50,000 more crushed beneath the darkness. Then, skin hanging like rags, hands on breasts, treading upon shattered human brains, crowds piled on the riverbank and on rafts fastened to the shore, turned gradually into corpses under the scorching sun. The conflagration shifts onto heaps of schoolgirls lying like refuse, so that God alone knew who they were. How could I forget that quiet which descended over a city of 300,000? The calm. How could I forget those pleas of a dying wife and child, emitted through the whiteness of their eyes, piercing our minds and souls? The crew members sat silently on the flights back to Tinian. Some took solace in the belief that what they had witnessed was so horrific that it would definitely end the war. Great artiste tail gunner Al Pappy DeHart said he wished he hadn't seen what he had just witnessed, adding, "I won't be mentioning it to my grandchildren. Not ever. I don't think it's the kind of thing to be telling kids. Not what we saw." Truman was dining on board the USS Augusta on his way back from Potsdam when he learned of Hiroshima. He jumped up and exclaimed, "This is the greatest thing in history." He shortly thereafter said that announcing the news of Hiroshima was the happiest announcement he had ever made. Truman's reported jubilation made some uncomfortable. One Democratic committee man admonished him by telegram 2 days later. "No president of the United States could ever be jubilant over any device that could kill innocent human beings. Please make it clear that it is not destruction, but the end of destruction that is the cause of jubilation." Soviet leaders were anything but jubilant. Knowing that the bomb was not needed to defeat a nation already on life support, they concluded that the Soviet Union was the real target. The Americans, they figured, wanted to speed the Japanese surrender in the hope of preempting Soviet gains in Asia. Even more disconcerting, they concluded that the Americans, by using it on Hiroshima when it was clearly not necessary, were signaling that the United States wouldn't hesitate to use it against them too if they threatened U.S. interests. The Russians got the message. Sunday Times correspondent Alexander Wirth, who spent 1941 to 1948 in Moscow, observed, "The news of Hiroshima had an acutely depressing effect on everybody. It was clearly realized that this was a new fact in the world's power politics, that the bomb constituted a threat to Russia, and some Russian pessimists I talked to that day dismally remarked that Russia's desperately hard victory over Germany was now as good as wasted." It was precisely the gratuitous nature of the bombings that haunted Marshal Zhukov's memories 26 years later, and made clear to him what their real intention was. He reflected, "It was clear already then that the U.S. government intended to use the atomic weapon for the purpose of achieving its imperialist goals from a position of strength in the Cold War." This was amply corroborated on August 6th and 8th. Without any military need whatsoever, the Americans dropped 2 atomic bombs on the peaceful and densely populated Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Other military leaders were also aghast. Gromyko's son, Anatoly, recalled his father telling him that Hiroshima set the heads of the Soviet military spinning. The mood in the Kremlin, in the general staff, was neurotic. The mistrust towards the Allies grew quickly. Opinions floated around to preserve a large land army, to establish controls over extended territories, to lessen potential losses from atomic bombings. Political leaders, including Stalin and Foreign Minister Vyacheslav Molotov, were equally alarmed. Physicist Yuli Karitin recalled that the whole Soviet government interpreted Hiroshima as atomic blackmail against the USSR, as a threat to unleash a new, even more terrible and devastating war. Nuclear physicists were summoned to the Kremlin for daily reports on their progress. Within days, Stalin had launched a crash program to build a Soviet bomb. Following Hiroshima, Japanese leaders pressed for a quick response from the Soviets on their willingness to mediate. They received a clear answer when, in the early hours of August 9th, the powerful Red Army smashed through Japan's forces in Manchuria, Korea, Sakhalin, and the Kurils, encountering little resistance. On the morning of August 9th, the 4 top foreign ministry officials went to Prime Minister Suzuki's residence to deliver the bad news. "What we feared has finally come," Suzuki responded. Later that morning, before Japan had time to react to the Soviet invasion, the United States dropped an implosive plutonium bomb, nicknamed Fat Man, on the city of Nagasaki. Poor visibility over the primary target, Kokura, forced the pilot, Charles Sweeney, to switch to downtown Nagasaki. The bomb landed 2 miles off target in the Urakami district, exploding over the largest Catholic cathedral in Asia, with a force of 21 kilotons. 40,000 people died immediately, including about 250 soldiers. 70,000 died by the end of 1945, and perhaps 140,000 in 5 years. Spitzer said that he and other crew members of the Great Artiste, after watching Hiroshima disappear, could not believe that a second city had been wiped off the face of the earth. There was no need for more missions, more bombs, more fear and more dying. Good God, any fool could see that. Telford Taylor, the chief prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials, observed, "The rights and wrongs of Hiroshima are debatable, but I have never heard a plausible justification of Nagasaki," which he considered a war crime. Japanese officials, despondent over the Soviet attack, held an emergency cabinet meeting at which they learned about Nagasaki. Neither that announcement nor Army Minister Anami's fallacious report that the United States had 100 more atomic bombs and Tokyo was the next target moved the participants closer to surrendering unconditionally. Most saw little difference between the United States wiping out entire cities with 300 planes and thousands of bombs, or doing so with one plane and one bomb. That the United States could and would burn down Japanese cities was an established fact. The Soviet invasion, however, totally demoralized the Japanese leaders. It proved the absolute bankruptcy of both Japan's diplomatic approach to the Soviet Union and its Ketsugo strategy of fiercely resisting a U.S. invasion. For Japanese leaders contemplating surrender, the atomic bombs provided an added inducement, but not the decisive one, although some of them latched on to them as a convenient excuse. The emperor announced his willingness to surrender, accepting the Potsdam Declaration, but only as long as it does not comprise any demand which prejudices the prerogatives of His Majesty as a sovereign ruler. Suzuki recognized that there was no choice. Japan must surrender immediately, he declared, or the Soviet Union will take not only Manchuria, Korea, Karafuto, but also Hokkaido. This would destroy the foundation of Japan. We must end the war when we can deal with the United States. Once the emperor's decision was clear, the three recalcitrant members of the Big Six, who had been holding out for three additional demands, self-disarmament, no war crimes trials, and no occupation, dropped their opposition to surrender. Thus, with the Red Army rapidly approaching the Japanese mainland, the Japanese leaders decided to surrender to the Americans, whom they viewed as much more likely to allow them to keep the emperor. They also feared that the advancing Red Army would trigger pro-communist uprisings inside Japan, as they had in parts of Europe. Truman and his advisors weighed the Japanese offer to surrender. Burns warned that retaining the emperor would lead to crucifixion of the president. Stimson disagreed, arguing that even if the question hadn't been raised by the Japanese, we would have to continue the emperor ourselves in order to get into surrender the many scattered armies of the Japanese who would own no other authority, and to save us from a score of bloody Iwo Jimas and Okinawas. In his diary, Stimson expressed his frustration with Burns. There has been a good deal of uninformed agitation against the emperor, by people who know no more about Japan than has been given them by Gilbert and Sullivan's Mikado, and I found today that, curiously enough, it had gotten deeply embedded in the minds of influential people in the State Department. After further debate, they compromised on a vague statement that promised, "The ultimate form of government shall, in accordance with the Potsdam Declaration, be established by the freely expressed will of the Japanese people." After the war, Japanese leaders attributed the surrender to both the atom bombs and the Soviet invasion. Although the interviews were carried out by U.S. occupation authorities, Several still gave primacy to the Soviet invasion, not the atomic bomb or other U.S. actions. Deputy Chief of Staff General Toroshiro Kawabe explained, "It was only in a gradual manner that the horrible wreckage which had been made of Hiroshima became known. In comparison, the Soviet entry into the war was a great shock when it actually came. Reports reaching Tokyo described Russian forces as invading in swarms. It gave us all the more severe shock and alarm because we had been in constant fear of it, with a vivid imagination that the vast Red Army forces in Europe were now being turned against us." Admiral Toyoda agreed. "I believe the Russian participation in the war against Japan, rather than the atom bombs, did more to hasten the surrender." Lieutenant General Sumihisa Ikeda, the director of Japan's General Planning Agency, said that, "Upon hearing of the Soviet entry into the war, I felt that our chances were gone." The Army Ministry responded similarly to a direct question from General Headquarters, stating, "The Soviet participation in the war had the most direct impact on Japan's decision to surrender." A study conducted by the U.S. War Department in January 1946 came to the same conclusion, finding little mention of the use of the atomic bomb by the United States in the discussions leading up to the decision. It is almost a certainty that the Japanese would have capitulated upon the entry of Russia into the war. Erroneously convinced that the bombs had ended the war, 85% of the American public approved of their use. Almost 23% wished that the Japanese hadn't surrendered so quickly, so that the United States could have dropped more atom bombs on them. But unknown to most of the public, many U.S. top military leaders considered the bombings either militarily unnecessary or morally reprehensible. Truman's Chief of Staff, Admiral William Leahy, who chaired the meetings of the Joint Chiefs, was the most impassioned, classifying the bomb with chemical and bacteriological weapons as violations of every Christian ethic I have ever heard of and all of the known laws of war. He proclaimed that the Japanese were already defeated and ready to surrender. The use of this barbarous weapon at Hiroshima and Nagasaki was of no material assistance in our war against Japan. In being the first to use it, we adopted an ethical standard common to the barbarians of the Dark Ages. I was not taught to make war in that fashion, and wars cannot be won by destroying women and children. Leahy angrily told the journalist Jonathan Daniels in 1949, "Truman told me it was agreed that they would use it only to hit military objectives. Of course, then they went ahead and killed as many women and children as they could, which was just what they wanted all the time." General Douglas MacArthur always maintained that the war would have ended months earlier if the United States had modified its surrender terms. In 1960, he told former President Hoover that if Hoover's wise and statesmanlike memo to Truman of May 30, 1945, advocating change in surrender terms had been acted on, it would have obviated the slaughter at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, in addition to much of the destruction by our bomber attacks. That the Japanese would have accepted it, and gladly, I have no doubt. General Henry Hap Arnold wrote, "It always appeared to us that, atomic bomb or no atomic bomb, the Japanese were already on the verge of collapse." Shortly after the war ended, General Curtis LeMay argued, "Even without the atomic bomb and the Russian entry into the war, Japan would have surrendered in 2 weeks. The atomic bomb had nothing to do with the end of the war." General Carl Tui Spatz, commander of the U.S. Strategic Air Forces in the Pacific, wrote in his diary 2 days after the bombing of Nagasaki, "When the atomic bomb was first discussed with me in Washington, I was not in favor of it, just as I have never favored the destruction of cities as such with all inhabitants being killed." Many naval officers agreed with the air chiefs. Admiral Ernest King, commander-in-chief of the U.S. Navy, told his aide, "I don't think we should do it at this time. It is not necessary." He told an interviewer, "I didn't like the atom bomb or any part of it. Admiral Chester Nimitz, Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet, told a gathering at the Washington Monument shortly after the war. The Japanese had, in fact, already sued for peace before the atomic age was announced to the world, with the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and before the Russian entry into the war. Admiral William Bull Halsey, commander of the South Pacific Fleet, said the following year, "The first atomic bomb was an unnecessary experiment. It was a mistake to ever drop it. It killed a lot of Japs, but the Japs had put out a lot of peace feelers through Russia long before." As Brigadier General Carter Clark, who was in charge of preparing summaries of intercepted diplomatic cables, stated, "We brought them down to an abject surrender through accelerated sinking of their merchant marine and hunger alone, and when we didn't need to do it, and we knew we didn't need to do it, and they knew we knew we didn't need to do it. We used them as an experiment for two atomic bombs." 6 of the United States' 7 five-star officers who received their final star in World War II, Generals MacArthur, Eisenhower, and Arnold, and Admirals Leahy, King, and Nimitz, rejected the idea that the atomic bombs were needed to end the war. Sadly, though, there is little evidence that they pressed their case with Truman before the fact. But Groves knew their views. Before Hiroshima, Groves had prepared an order requiring U.S. commanders in the field to first clear all statements on the bombings with the War Department, because, as Groves admitted, "We didn't want MacArthur and others saying the war could have been won without the bomb." In late August, even Jimmy Burns admitted that the bomb wasn't needed to end the war. The New York Times reported that Burns had cited what he called Russian proof that the Japanese knew that they were beaten before the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. The Vatican quickly condemned the bombing. Catholic World described the bomb's use as atrocious and abominable, the most powerful blow ever delivered against Christian civilization and the moral law. Federal Council of Churches leader John Foster Dulles, Eisenhower's future hawkish Secretary of State, worried, "If we, a professedly Christian nation, feel morally free to use atomic energy in that way, men elsewhere will accept that verdict. Atomic weapons will be looked upon as a normal part of the arsenal of war, and the stage will be set for the sudden and final destruction of mankind." Others also deplored the bombings. University of Chicago President Robert Hutchins participated in a University of Chicago roundtable discussion on Atomic Force, Its Meaning for Mankind, broadcast on NBC on August 12th, just 3 days after the bombing of Nagasaki. Hutchins declared, "This is the kind of weapon that should be used, if at all, only as a last resort and in self-defense. At the time this bomb was dropped, the American authorities knew that Russia was going to enter the war. It was said that Japan was blockaded and its cities burned out. All the evidence points to the fact that the use of this bomb was unnecessary. Therefore, the United States has lost its moral prestige." Brave young Americans like Paul Fussell and their Soviet and British counterparts defeated Japan in World War II. Many lost their lives in the process. Yet the myth has been promulgated by Truman, Stimson, and others that the atomic bomb was responsible for the Allied victory, and that it saved hundreds of thousands of American lives by ending the war without a U.S. invasion. In 1991, former President George Herbert Walker Bush went so far as to defend Truman's tough, calculating decision which spared millions of American lives. The facts show otherwise. Though the atomic bombs certainly contributed to the Japanese decision to surrender, they were ancillary to U.S. island-hopping, bombing, and blockade, and to the dramatic impact of the Soviet invasion, which convinced the Japanese leaders that even holding on for the last decisive battle on the Japanese mainland was no longer a viable option. Nor was it for the Americans. As Leahy confessed, "I was unable to see any justification from a national defense point of view for an invasion of an already thoroughly defeated Japan." Nor did dropping atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki make the Soviet Union more pliable. It merely convinced Stalin that the United States would stop at nothing to impose its will, and that the Soviets must speed the development of their own atomic bomb as a deterrent to the bloodthirsty Americans. And in what many consider a cruel irony, the United States allowed Japan to keep the emperor, whose retention, most experts believed, was essential to post-war social stability. Contrary to Burns's admonitions, Truman suffered no political repercussions from that decision. The nuclear arms race that Szilard and others feared was now underway. Truman had helped make real his nightmarish vision of a world poised on the brink of annihilation. Stimson made the same point in his 1947 defense of the bombing, writing, "In this last great action of the Second World War, we were given final proof that war is death. War in the 20th century has grown steadily more barbarous, more destructive, more debased in all its aspects. Now, with the release of atomic energy, man's ability to destroy himself is very nearly complete." Truman always claimed that he felt no remorse, even bragging that he never lost any sleep over that decision. When television interviewer Edward R. Murrow asked him, "Any regrets?" he responded, "Not the slightest, not the slightest in the world." When another interviewer asked if the decision had been morally difficult to make, he responded, "Hell no, I made it like that," snapping his fingers. Truman met Oppenheimer for the first time on October 25, 1945, and asked him to guess when the Soviets would develop a bomb. When Oppenheimer admitted that he didn't know, Truman declared that he did. Never. Unnerved by this truculent display of ignorance, Oppenheimer said at one point, "Mr. President, I feel I have blood on my hands." Truman responded angrily, "I told him the blood was on my hands, to let me worry about that." Afterward, Truman told Dean Acheson, "I don't want to see that son of a bitch in this office ever again." He later called Oppenheimer a crybaby scientist. The horrors and bloodshed of World War II hardened a lot of people to the suffering of others. Future renowned physicist Freeman Dyson, who was then ready to go to Okinawa as part of the Tiger Force fleet of 300 British bombers, tried to illuminate the process. "I found this continuing slaughter of defenseless Japanese even more sickening than the slaughter of well-defended Germans, but still I did not quit. By that time I had been at war so long that I could hardly remember peace. No living poet had words to describe that emptiness of the soul, which allowed me to go on killing without hatred and without remorse. But Shakespeare understood it, and he gave Macbeth the words, 'I am in blood, steeped in so that, should I wade no more, returning were as tedious as going o'er.'" Writer and social critic Dwight MacDonald captured this dehumanization even before Hiroshima's devastation. He traced the transformation from the unbelievable horror and indignation people felt when Franco's planes killed hundreds of Spanish civilians in 1938, to the abject indifference to hundreds of thousands of victims in Tokyo. "We have grown callous to massacre. King Mithridates is said to have immunized himself against poison by taking small doses which he increased slowly. So the gradually increasing horrors of the last decade have made each of us, to some extent, a moral Mithridates, immunized against human sympathy." Not all were immunized against human sympathy. Many of the scientists involved in the bomb project became lifelong anti-nuclear activists, like Leo Szilard, who switched from physics to biology and founded the Council for a Livable World. Albert Einstein, who became the chair of the Emergency Committee of Atomic Scientists in 1946, and Joseph Rotblat, who campaigned tirelessly for nuclear abolition until his death at 96 and won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1995. Even British Prime Minister Winston Churchill recognized the difficulty of defending the atomic bombings. Churchill visited Truman toward the end of his presidency. Truman threw a small dinner to which he invited Robert Lovett, Omar Bradley, Harriman, and Acheson. Margaret, the president's daughter, described the scene. Everyone was in an ebullient mood, especially Dad. Without warning, Mr. Churchill turned to him and said, "Mr. President, I hope you have your answer ready for that hour when you and I stand before St. Peter and he says, 'I understand you two are responsible for putting off those atomic bombs. What have you got to say for yourselves?'" The atomic bombings would not be the only thing Churchill and Truman would have to answer for, as the United States and Great Britain charged toward confrontation with the Soviet Union. The person who did the most to try to stop that confrontation, Henry Wallace, has been largely lost to history. Few people remember how close Wallace came to getting the vice presidential nomination on that steamy Chicago night in July 1944. What might this country have become had Wallace succeeded Roosevelt in April 1945 instead of Truman? Would atomic bombs still have been used in World War II? Could we have avoided the nuclear arms race and the Cold War? Would civil rights and women's rights have triumphed in the immediate post-war years? Might colonialism have ended decades earlier, and the fruits of science and technology been spread more equitably around the globe? We'll never know. Chapter 5. The Cold War. Who started it? Men and women a century from now will very likely find the Cold War as obscure and incomprehensible as we today find the 30 Years' War, the terrible conflict that devastated much of Europe not too long ago. Looking back at the 20th century, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. wisely observed, our descendants will very likely be astonished at the disproportion between the causes of the Cold War, which may well seem trivial, and the consequences, which could have meant the veritable end of history. Did the Cold War have to be fought the way it was, with U.S. and Soviet nuclear weapons poised to destroy each other and wipe out all the rest of humanity as collateral damage? Could the Cold War have been avoided entirely? Were there statesmen who offered a dramatically different vision of a post-war world, based on peaceful and friendly competition that would uplift all of humanity? The early Cold War would be animated by the clash between two fundamentally different visions of the U.S. role in the world. Henry Luce's hegemonic vision of the 20th century as the American century, and Henry Wallace's utopian vision of the century of the common man. The stakes would be enormous. On September 2, 1945, the Second World War officially ended. Though Americans everywhere were cheered by that news, a strange pall hung over the nation, as Americans envisioned their own future in the burned-out ruins of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. On August 12th, CBS newsman Edward R. Murrow observed, "Seldom, if ever, has a war ended, leaving the victors with such a sense of uncertainty and fear, with such a realization that the future is obscure and that survival is not assured." Public discourse was rife with apocalyptic forebodings, as Americans were struck by what historian Paul Boyer describes as a primal fear of extinction. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch worried that science may have signed the mammalian world's death certificate. John Campbell, editor of Astounding Science Fiction magazine, admitted that he had been contemplating this development for 15 years and added, "Frankly, I am scared." This was not just a new bomb. It was, he explained, the power to kill the human race. The New York Times regretted that humans could now blow ourselves and perhaps the planet itself to drifting dust. The Washington Post lamented that the life expectancy of the human species had dwindled immeasurably in the course of two brief weeks. War's end left much of Europe and Asia in tatters, As many as 70 million people lay dead. Civilian deaths outnumbered military deaths by more than 3-2. The Soviet losses were unparalleled, as retreating German troops destroyed everything in their path. President John F. Kennedy later remarked, "No nation in the history of battle ever suffered more than the Soviet Union in the Second World War. At least 20 million lost their lives. Countless millions of homes and families were burned or sacked. A third of the nation's territory, including two-thirds of its industrial base, were turned into a wasteland, a loss equivalent to the destruction of this country east of Chicago." Only the United States escaped such destruction. The U.S. economy was booming. GNP and exports more than doubled pre-war levels. Industrial production soared, growing during the war at a record 15% annually. The United States held two-thirds of the world's gold reserves and three-quarters of its invested capital. It produced a phenomenal 50% of the world's goods and services. Yet businessmen and planners worried that the end of wartime spending augured a return to pre-war depression conditions. They particularly feared the consequences should Europe adopt economic spheres closed to American trade and investment. With Franklin Roosevelt at the helm, the United States skillfully steered a middle course between Great Britain and the Soviet Union. Most Americans looked askance at British imperialism and disapproved of Great Britain's repressive policies in Greece, India, and elsewhere. Many also mistrusted Soviet-style socialism and decried the Soviet Union's heavy-handed treatment of Eastern Europe. After the war, the United States used a $3.75 billion credit to pry open the British Empire, gaining equal access for American capital and goods. It also canceled Great Britain's lend-lease debt. The United States disappointed the Soviet Union by not offering similar aid, although it had dangled the prospect of a large credit during wartime discussions. Harry Truman, unfortunately, showed none of Roosevelt's dexterity in navigating an independent course as he tacked increasingly toward the British camp, ignoring Soviet concerns at a time of maximum U.S. strength and relative Soviet weakness. In mid-September, Secretary of State James Burns traveled to London to confer with Vyacheslav Molotov and other foreign ministers. Before leaving, he made clear his intention to use the U.S. atomic monopoly to force Soviet compliance with U.S. demands. But whenever Burns insisted the Soviets open up Eastern Europe, Molotov pointed to exclusionary U.S. policies in Italy, Greece, and Japan. Tired of Burns's belligerence, Molotov finally asked if he was hiding an atomic bomb in his coat pocket, to which Burns replied, "You don't know Southerners. We carry our artillery in our pocket. If you don't cut out all this stalling, I'm going to pull an atomic bomb out of my hip pocket and let you have it." U.S. atomic diplomacy, in its first iteration, had clearly failed to produce the desired results. Secretary of War Henry Stimson objected to such crude intimidation. In a September memo, Stimson had advised Truman that bullying the Soviets with atomic weapons would backfire and only speed the Soviet Union's efforts to attain its own atomic arsenal. "Our satisfactory relations with Russia are not merely connected with, but virtually dominated by, the problem of the atomic bomb. If we have this weapon rather ostentatiously on our hip, their suspicions and their distrust of our purposes and motives will increase. The chief lesson that I have learned in a long life is that the only way you can make a man trustworthy is to trust him, and the surest way to make him untrustworthy is to distrust him and show your distrust." Stimson boldly called for halting U.S. development of atomic bombs if Great Britain and the Soviet Union did likewise, and impounding those the United States had already built. Truman dedicated the September 21st cabinet meeting to Stimson's urgent appeal to strengthen the U.S. friendship with the Soviet Union before it developed its own atomic bombs. The meeting, occurring on Stimson's 78th birthday, would be the last for the retiring statesman. The cabinet split sharply over Stimson's proposals, with Secretary of Commerce Henry Wallace rallying supporters, and Secretary of the Navy James Forrestal leading the opposition. Forrestal would play an important role in the hardening of U.S. policy toward the Soviet Union. He had earned a fortune on Wall Street and married a former Ziegfeld Follies girl before joining the White House staff in 1939. Like most other Wall Streeters, he deeply distrusted the Soviet Union. He leaked a phony account of the cabinet discussion to the press. The next day, the New York Times reported that Wallace had proposed sharing the secret of the atomic bomb with the USSR. Though Truman immediately repudiated this flagrant falsehood and set the record straight, Wallace could see the writing on the wall. Having just returned from a conference on atomic energy at the University of Chicago, Wallace understood the real stakes better than Truman and other administration officials. The experts agreed that whatever secret there might have been to the atomic bomb had vanished when the United States dropped the first one on Hiroshima. They also knew, as the Front Committee had warned in June, that the Soviet Union would soon develop its own atomic arsenal. The scientists in attendance drove home the fact that the current generation of atomic weapons paled by comparison to what would soon be available. Therefore, they concluded, steps to curb an arms race were essential and urgent. Wallace had told the gathering that any nation that violates the international moral law sooner or later gets into trouble. The British have done that in relation to colonial peoples, and the United States is in danger of doing it with the atomic bomb. He conveyed that same message to his fellow cabinet members. A few days later, Wallace received a letter from physicist Arthur Holly Compton. Compton alerted Wallace to ominous developments at the weapons laboratories. "There is a reasonable chance," he reported, "that a concentrated scientific and technical effort, comparable with that spent on the development of the present atom bomb, could develop a super-bomb of staggering destructive capability." He expressed the deeply held view among the members of the scientific panel of the interim committee. "We feel that this should not be undertaken, because we prefer defeat in war to a victory obtained at the expense of the enormous human disaster that would be caused by its use." Compton presented some rough figures to show just how powerful a bomb he was talking about. "The area completely destroyed by one atomic bomb, 4 square miles. Area completely destroyable by 1,000 atomic bombs, as in a future war, 4,000 square miles. Area completely destroyable by 1,000 super bombs, about 1,000,000 square miles. Area of continental United States, about 3,000,000 square miles." What worried Compton was that the theoretical basis of the superbomb has arisen spontaneously, with at least 4 persons working on our project who have independently brought the idea to me. This means that it will occur likewise to those in other nations engaged on similar developments. If developed here, other great powers must follow suit. Wallace and Compton both felt that only some form of world government could meet such a challenge. Wallace fought a rearguard action against the powerful forces propelling the country toward war with the Soviet Union. Truman's ouster of the few remaining New Dealers from his cabinet left Wallace increasingly isolated. Now Stimson too was gone. As Soviet intelligence noted, the rightward shift in Truman's economic and foreign policy advisers was unmistakable. Wallace, undeterred, met with Truman on October 15th to press him on softening his tone toward the Soviet Union and gave him a report he had written titled "The Significance of the Atomic Age." Truman read it sentence by sentence in his presence. It warned, "When many nations have atomic bombs, it will require only the smallest spark to set off a worldwide humanity-destroying explosion. Steps should be taken at once to call into being a vital international organization based on the elimination of all weapons of offensive warfare, the pooling of the constructive aspects of atomic energy, and the adoption of the principle of international trusteeship for certain areas of the world. Truman agreed completely, telling Wallace that this was what he had been trying to say right along. He also remarked, somewhat overgenerously, that Stalin was a fine man who wanted to do the right thing. Truman even agreed with Wallace's statement that the purpose of Britain was to promote an unbreachable break between us and Russia. Wallace's efforts bore fruit. In the fall of 1945, Truman told a press conference, "Russia's interests and ours do not clash and never have. We have always been friends, and I hope we always will be." With the nuclear issue looming large, scientists descended on Washington to promote international control of atomic energy and prevent military control of atomic research. Wallace supported their efforts, testifying before the Senate Special Committee on Atomic Energy that the May-Johnson bill, by providing for military oversight of peacetime nuclear research, would set up the most undemocratic, dictatorial arrangements that have ever been proposed to the Congress in a major legislative measure. Its passage would threaten to deliver the American people into the hands of military fascism. Wallace further pressed Truman to remove control of U.S. atomic weapons from Leslie Groves and require authorization of the President, Secretary of State, Secretary of War, and Secretary of the Navy before they could be used. Wallace feared that given Soviet hater Groves's unilateral control over the nuclear arsenal, he might launch an atomic attack on his own authority. Such a fear was not as far-fetched as it might seem. In late 1945, Groves openly advocated a preemptive attack against the Soviet Union. He reasoned that the United States had two choices. It could quickly reach an agreement with the Soviets, ensuring that nobody used atomic bombs under any circumstances. But such an agreement, he believed, would necessarily entail the abandonment of all rights of privacy, that of the home, the laboratory, and the industrial plant throughout the world, including the United States. Failure to reach an agreement, however, would mean the United States, Great Britain, and the Soviet Union all having atomic bombs. In that case, he contended, the United States must for all time maintain absolute supremacy in atomic weapons, including number, size and power, efficiency, means for immediate offensive use, and defensive against atomic attack. We must also have a worldwide intelligence service, which will keep us at all times completely informed of any activities of other nations in the atomic field, and of their military intentions. That would lead to an atomic arms race. But he didn't think that the world could long survive such a race. Therefore, he concluded, the United States should not permit any potential rival to make or possess atomic weapons. If such a country started to make atomic weapons, we would destroy its capacity to make them before it had progressed far enough to threaten us. The scientists, in their efforts to achieve international control of atomic power and to ensure civilian control at home, always viewed Wallace as their most trustworthy ally in the administration. Oppenheimer visited him in October and voiced the scientists' distress over the growing tension with the Soviet Union and the fact that Burns was using the bomb as a pistol to get what we wanted in international diplomacy. He knew the Russians would respond very quickly, developing their own bomb. Oppenheimer complained that the heart has completely gone out of the scientists. All they think about now are the social and economic implications of the bomb. Wallace was shaken by seeing Oppenheimer so agitated. I never saw a man in such an extremely nervous state as Oppenheimer. He seemed to feel that the destruction of the entire human race was imminent. Wallace shared Oppenheimer's concern about the precarious nature of the international situation and encouraged him to speak directly with Truman. Unsettled by the encounter with Oppenheimer, Wallace commented, "The guilt consciousness of the atomic bomb scientists is one of the most astounding things I have ever seen." Oppenheimer took Wallace's advice and met with Truman 6 days later. The meeting could not have gone worse. Truman stressed national considerations in passing an Atomic Energy Act. Oppenheimer pressed for international control. The meeting ended disastrously with Oppenheimer's confession of guilt over the bomb. Wallace persevered in his effort to mitigate the influence of Truman's conservative advisors, who preferred confrontation with the Soviet Union over continuing the wartime alliance. They saw malign intent in every Soviet action. Wallace encouraged Truman to understand how his words and actions looked to Soviet leaders. Following the cabinet meeting the day after Truman's unfortunate encounter with Oppenheimer, Wallace stayed behind to speak with the president. He again urged Truman to be even-handed with Great Britain and the Soviet Union, and to offer the Soviet Union a loan comparable to the one the United States had offered Great Britain. He compared U.S. dictating election results in Cuba and Mexico to the way the Soviets exerted control over the Balkan states. Truman, as always, agreed completely with Wallace's analysis of events. The effects of Wallace's repeated interventions were usually short-lived. Truman's other advisors discerned a more threatening pattern in Soviet actions, and succeeded in convincing the president to view the world through their prism. By November, they were referring to Wallace and Truman's progressive friends as Reds, and telling Truman, "Don't pay any attention to what those Reds want you to do." Meanwhile, Soviet leaders were pursuing their own agenda, securing their gains in Eastern Europe and Asia, rebuilding their shattered economy, and making certain that Germany and Japan never again posed a threat to Soviet security. They were well positioned to act on those interests. With communists having played a leading role in anti-fascist resistance movements, beleaguered Europeans often welcomed Soviet troops as liberators. Communist Party membership soared across Europe. Communists won more than 20% of the vote in France, Italy, and Finland in 1945. With European populations uprooted, homeless, hungry, and unemployed, the prospect seemed ripe for further communist gains. In Italy, where 1.7 million joined the party, real wages in 1945 were barely a quarter of 1913 levels, and GNP was at 1911 levels. Undersecretary of State Dean Acheson worried that Europe would turn towards socialism, leaving the United States isolated. "They have suffered so much, and they believe so deeply that governments can take some action which will alleviate their sufferings, that they will demand that the whole business of state control and state interference shall be pushed further and further." But the Soviet Union, adhering to wartime understandings and hoping to maintain the wartime alliance, went out of its way to restrain its frustrated communist allies in China, Italy, France, and Greece. In early 1946, a Gallup poll found that only 26% of Americans thought the Soviets sought world domination. 13% thought the British did. During these early post-war months, Truman vacillated in his attitude toward Stalin, often likening him to Boss Pendergast in Kansas City. Others did likewise. Even Averell Harriman, a fierce critic who worked with Stalin as ambassador during the war, recognized the complexity of his personality. "It is hard for me to reconcile the courtesy and consideration that he showed me personally with the ghastly cruelty of his wholesale liquidations. Others, who did not know him personally, see only the tyrant in Stalin. I saw the other side as well. His high intelligence, that fantastic grasp of detail, his shrewdness, and his surprising human sensitivity that he was capable of showing. I found him better informed than Roosevelt, more realistic than Churchill, in some ways the most effective of the war leaders. For me, Stalin remains the most inscrutable and contradictory character I have ever known." With tensions over Poland having eased, Germany would provide an early test case for post-war cooperation. After Germany's surrender, the Allies divided the country into Soviet, U.S., British, and French zones. Roosevelt had first supported the Morgenthau Plan for pastoralization of Germany, to ensure that it never again posed a threat to its neighbors. "We have to be tough with Germany," he told Morgenthau in August 1944. "We either have to castrate the German people, or you have got to treat them in such a manner so they can't just go on reproducing people who want to continue the way they have in the past." But the United States reversed itself once it became convinced that restoration of the German economy would be key to overall European recovery. This placed the Western powers at odds with the Soviets, who feared German revitalization, and were busy stripping the Eastern Zone of assets to ship back to the Soviet Union. These conflicting interests impeded the creation of a unified Germany, thereby planting the seeds for later conflict, while Germans struggled to eke out a living regardless of which zone they lived in. The first major superpower conflict erupted in the Middle East, not Europe, as Stalin moved to expand Soviet influence in Iran and Turkey at declining Britain's expense. The Middle East had assumed increased strategic significance following completion of the Suez Canal in 1869 and the introduction of long-distance air routes in the early 20th century. English historian Arnold Toynbee described it as the shortest route between the two chief concentrations of population and power in the world of the 20th century. India, East Asia, and the Pacific on the one hand, and Europe, America, and the Atlantic on the other. He explained that command of the Middle East carried with it the power of keeping open the direct routes between those two geographical poles, or closing them, or forcing them open again. The Soviet Union had long coveted the Turkish Straits, which would have allowed it access to the Mediterranean, and Stalin believed that he had won that concession from Roosevelt and Churchill during the war. He now pressured Turkey to build joint military bases in the Straits. The ensuing conflict, like everything else in the Middle East, revolved around oil. At the start of the war, the United States accounted for 61% of overall world oil production. Great Britain controlled 72% of Middle Eastern oil, the United States only 10%. The United States now sought a bigger share in the Middle East. Saudi Arabia held the key to U.S. ambitions. In 1943, the United States extended lend-lease aid to the oil-rich sheikdom. The following year, Saudi King Ibn Saud granted the United States permission to construct an airbase at Dhahran. In a 1944 meeting with British Ambassador Lord Halifax, Roosevelt drew a map of Middle Eastern oil holdings and informed Halifax that Iranian oil belonged to Great Britain, Saudi oil to the United States, and Iraqi and Kuwaiti oil to both. The following year, Roosevelt concluded a deal with Ibn Saud, pledging U.S. support in return for exclusive access to Saudi oil. Truman understood the importance of maintaining U.S. control of this vital resource. In August 1945, Gordon Merriam, chief of the State Department Near East Division, alerted Truman to the fact that Saudi Arabia's oil resources were a stupendous source of strategic power and one of the greatest material prizes in human history. Iran was another prize. In September 1941, tired of Reza Shah Pahlavi's erratic behavior and questionable loyalties, Britain and the USSR invaded and occupied the country, forcing Reza Shah into exile and replacing him with his 21-year-old son. Having eyed Iran's rich oil reserves since the 1920s, the United States now maneuvered to expand its influence, offering lend-lease aid and sending in civilian and military advisors. In 1943, Secretary of State Cordell Hull explained to Roosevelt why it was essential to limit British and Soviet power. "It is to our interest that no great power be established on the Persian Gulf, opposite the important American petroleum developments in Saudi Arabia." Like Great Britain and the United States, the Soviet Union did indeed have designs on Iranian oil. Stalin wanted to develop the oil fields in northern Iran. He also worried about the security of the Soviet Union's Baku oil fields, which were only 100 miles north of the Russo-Iranian border. Stalin pressed Iran for oil concessions comparable to those granted to Great Britain and the United States, and, with troops remaining in the country from World War II, supported a separatist uprising in Iran's northern provinces to force Iran's hand. Churchill, meanwhile, itched for a confrontation with the Soviet Union. A rabid anti-communist and unabashed imperialist, Churchill had tried to draw the United States into military engagement with the Soviet Union as far back as 1918. Though forced to defer his long-sought confrontation during the war, he pounced as soon as the opportunity presented itself. Soviet probes in Iran and Turkey had threatened the British sphere in the Middle East and Mediterranean, and Great Britain's hold on India seemed precarious. The exposure of a Soviet atomic espionage ring in Canada in early February added credibility to warnings issued by Forrestal, Leahy, and other hardliners. A speech that month by Stalin raised further hackles, though it was actually much less inflammatory than Soviet expert George Kennan and others contended. Anti-Soviet sentiments were clearly on the rise in early March 1946, when Churchill spoke in Fulton, Missouri, with Truman sitting on the platform. His bellicose words delivered a sharp, perhaps fatal blow to any prospects for post-war comedy. From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. Police governments are prevailing in a great number of countries. The communist parties or fifth columns constitute a growing challenge and peril to Christian civilization. I do not believe that Soviet Russia desires war. What they desire is the fruits of war and the indefinite expansion of their power and doctrines. Stalin responded angrily.